Yeah, so we like to call ourselves a human-involved robotics company. And so we're kind of, to your point about sort of creating this new category, we kind of sit in this interesting place between people who are doing straight up hand construction, either using like old Japanese techniques, things like that. And then all the way on the other end of the spectrum is like fully automated $100,000 gantry CNC that's churning out tables for IKEA, right? So we're at this interesting place in the middle, which is a lot of what really excites me about Shaper, where we're really just giving people superpowers. We're augmenting your existing capabilities. So we think that there's something to be said, and people really like being in the loop when it comes to making stuff. You get a much different feeling when you say, okay, I wanna make this chair. It's one thing if you, okay, like great, the chair can be made out of flat plywood construction and put together with no joints, and you put it on a CNC machine, it cuts all the things out for you, and it's like, okay, you have a chair. That's a very different feeling from, okay, I wanna make this chair, I'm gonna get this tool out, and I'm gonna physically be making this myself. And at the end of the day, when you look at that chair, you feel a lot different about a chair that you made with Shaper Origin versus one that came out of a CNC.
Welcome back to the Make or Break show, where each week we bring you stories of incredible makers and the make or break moments that have defined them along the way. I'm your host, Brandon Cullum, and this week we chat with Jeremy Bloom, the head of electrical engineering at Shaper Tools. What exactly is a handheld computer-controlled router? And did President Obama really tweet at Jeremy during his graduation? Find out after the jump. What is up, guys? Welcome back to the Make or Break show. Hope your week is going great and you guys are having fun. Whether you're driving in your car or you're working in your shop, I hope you guys are enjoying this podcast and these interviews. This thing has been an absolute blast to put together, and I'm really looking forward to 2018, and I have a lot of fun guests that I've actually already recorded, as well as many more that are scheduled and some big plans that are coming up. So you guys might have seen this already, and you might have seen some other podcasts do this, but there is some costs that go into producing this podcast, as well as just the cost of my time in producing it. I love doing it, and I want to make this the best that I can for you guys. So I actually want to put in some more time to it to do the best that I can. But to do that, I'm going to need your guys' support. So I've put together a Patreon for this podcast. So you guys can head over there's a link in the show notes. Or if you go to patreon.com/makeorbreakshow, you can check it out. And if you guys have not heard of Patreon and how it works, it's basically like a Kickstarter, but it is on a monthly basis. So like back in the day when Michelangelo was working on the Sistine Chapel or whatever, the Medici's were his patrons and provide him financial means to get his art out. And so that's kind of the way the Patreon works. And with that, we got some fun levels, as well as some fun things you guys can get. You guys can check all that out, everything from stickers to coming on the show as a guest to actually getting priority to where your questions can get answered on the show. And then I have a couple goals that are coming up that I'm really excited about. One that I think all of you guys will enjoy is I really want to make these shows live and have them on a consistent basis where you can actually join live and interact with our guests and get your answers or get your questions answered during the show. So that's one of the big things I want to push towards, but some of the stuff I got to do, your support would be greatly appreciated. So sales pitch over, would love your guys' support. Even if you don't, I really just appreciate the fact you guys are listening. So this is always going to stay free for you guys, but if you are interested in helping me make this, that would be absolutely amazing. So let's get into our interview with Jeremy. Jeremy Bloom, he's got a BS and a master's in electrical and computer engineering from Cornell. We get into some cool projects that he did while he was there, including this really cool graduation cap that lit up and people could tweet and it would display a certain color. And so he took that kind of hacker mentality all the way to Google, where he was actually on the electrical engineering team for Google Glass. So you guys remember those glasses from back in the day where you could record. So he gets into that story, which is pretty crazy. And then what I think is most fascinating about his story is, for a guy who's especially into computers and electrical, Google kind of seems to be the mecca, and that seems to be the place you'd want to land. But he actually now went on to Shaper. And you guys might have seen Shaper Tools popping up here recently. I know they have partnered with Festool. And so Shaper Tools, they have this router called Shaper Origin that is computer controlled. You still are controlling it with your hands, but it's almost like autocorrect for your router. So you can be off a little bit on the line that you're trying to cut out, and it's going to adjust for you. It's really cool. It's kind of hard to explain. Tested, the folks over at tested.com, they put out a great video that walks through that, and that was actually in early January. I'll include a link in the show notes for that to check it out. But we get into not only the development of Shaper, but also how they kind of see Shaper fitting into the whole woodworking space and kind of the future of tools when you integrate some of the really cool things that computers can do, as well as the love that we all like to have being hands-on in the things that we make. So without further ado, let's get into our interview with Jeremy, as well as finding out why he was the most mysterious senior at Cornell. When I was looking through some of your bio stuff, I think the stat that stood out to me the most, and I want to get the story behind it, is you were named one of the most mysterious seniors. I guess you're a senior year for undergrad, is that right?
Yeah.
So what was that about?
I don't know. It was like a thing that the school newspaper does every year, where they highlight however many 25 seniors, something like that, who are doing interesting things, and they feel like people should see the things that they're doing, but yeah, they're kind of like maybe flying a little under the radar. That's kind of my MO. I just like focusing on doing whatever I want to do, and I'm going to do it because it's fun and it's awesome, and if other people notice it, cool. If they don't, I don't really care. I'm just doing it because it's a good time.
Yeah, yeah. When I saw it, I was like, is this like the world's most interesting man, like that type of thing? I'm like, what is about that? Well, that totally makes sense. I mean, because you have been doing a ton of really cool things. Before even getting into college, as far as electrical and like software development and programming, was that something, like, were you always that kid just tinkering with stuff growing up?
I was a big tinkerer growing up, definitely more towards the mechanical side of things when I was younger. I loved building stuff, Legos, Kinects, big, insane monstrosities. My dad and my grandfather both have backgrounds in woodworking. So I did a bunch of woodworking when I was younger too. And, you know, we'll talk more about this later, I'm sure. But now I work at a company that makes woodworking tools effectively.
Yeah.
But it's been cool to go back to that, because the last time I'd done it before coming to Shaper, I was like 12 or 13, and I was really into it back then, and it kind of fell by the wayside in favor of electronics, but I always loved it. But yeah, I've been tinkering since a young age, breaking things. It was apparently also, you know, in addition to building stuff, my parents tell me that when they would bring me over to other people's houses when I was a kid, my thing was like rearranging their furniture.
Yeah.
When I was little, I'd push all the furniture around their house. I don't know if I was working on the feng shui or I just wanted to see how things fit together, but yeah, that was always my thing.
That's awesome. That's real cool. Yeah, I guess that makes sense, because that was going to be a kind of a big question, because, I mean, once you get out of college, it seems like you go the hardcore tech route, and then it's almost like a left turn back to Shaper and the making side, but there's definitely a through line through it all. But the first thing I wanted to get into with you was your graduation cap. I think that was the very first thing I saw that you did that was internet controlled, for folks that haven't seen it. So what was kind of the idea behind that? And like, did you expect it to get like as out there? Like it definitely was not under the radar from what I could tell.
Yeah. So the story behind that was, so I did a 1 year master's. And so the year before that I had my undergrad graduation. A friend of mine, you know, it's a common thing to decorate your graduation hat. People put tinfoil on it and things like that, because it's a big crowd of tens of thousands of students, and all the parents are up in the stands and they're trying to see where their kid is. Not that it really matters, because you know, it's just a bunch of people in black robes walking. But anyway, people want to see where their kid is, so people put identifiers on their caps. So for my undergrad graduation, it was just a super last-minute thing. A friend of mine was like, I'm surprised yours doesn't have LEDs on it. And I was like, oh, well, it totally should. So the night before, I just, you know, hooked up a couple LEDs and put them on my hat. And it was fun. But the graduation's outside in New York in the summer. It's super sunny, super hot. And the LEDs were not bright enough. No one could see them or anything. So I resolved, since I knew I was going to be doing it again the following year for my master's graduation, I resolved to, in advance of that graduation, make something more sophisticated. So that was where that project came from. And my my master's thesis was focused on LED lighting.
Oh, cool.
So I happened to have a lot of very, very, very bright LEDs.
Yeah.
I happened to already have a bunch of PCBs made up for them that were controllable. So I just kind of hooked that up to the web, made an app so that anyone could control it over Twitter. And it would, you know, tweet out the color and stuff, and you could set it. And I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was, you know, several hundred times brighter than the one from the previous year. It was very much like a spotlight on top of my head. So it was very easy to see me from the stands.
Yeah, that's so cool. Yeah, I went to Georgia Tech, and so we had a lot of folks just with like LEDs that would blink, but I don't think anything was like controlled, especially online. And so that was how did people know to tweet at you?
I think I like sent out a bunch of posts on Facebook and Twitter and stuff, and I was like, "Hey everyone, I'm graduating tomorrow. If you go to this website, you can control what color my head is in real time." Have fun. That's real cool.
And I saw that you could put in like whatever Twitter account. And so I think you had a screenshot where it was like Obama told you to do like some color, but it's someone else putting in. I thought that was really awesome.
I wasn't validating. I wasn't like making you sign in to Twitter to do it. So it was just like you select the color and then you input your Twitter username, whatever username you want. It doesn't actually have to be yours.
Yeah.
And then once it would get put into a queue and the color would change every couple of seconds. And so once it got to your color, because the queue is building up, once it actually got to displaying your color, it would tweet at that username and say, "Hey, thanks, you know, whatever insert username here for said, I just set it to red or whatever color you wanted." So people got funny and put in Obama's Twitter account and the president of the university's Twitter account. It was a good time.
That's awesome. That's real cool. It's something that was really neat. Is I know, especially in college, you can kind of get lost in the theoretical and not the hands-on stuff, but it feels like you were working for companies or the stuff you're doing with Pop Shop. You always were trying to bring like practical projects to your work. What was kind of that motivation behind that? Like, why did you still want to stay really hands-on and work on actual solutions and stuff?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, Cornell especially has a reputation in the engineering school of being a really good engineering school, but being very, very technical, in the weeds, and maybe not always with the most practical things.
Yeah.
And that's actually an effort. They've made an effort in the last few years to change that a little bit. I would hope, at least in a little part, due to some of the things that I did there, and you know, I was in constant communication with the administration about this, about having more practical projects. And it's tough because you gotta balance these things. Having the theoreticals is good and important, and I actually do use them in my work. But if you don't have enough practical projects to apply them while you're in school, then it's easy to lose sight of like, okay, why am I learning differential equations again? What's the practical application here? And there are practical applications, but sometimes they get lost on students, especially, you know, you're taking five classes at a time. Your last thought is not, wow, how can I apply this to something interesting? It's like, oh my God, how can I finish all the homework I have to do tonight?
Yeah.
So one thing that, you know, I honestly wish I even figured out a little sooner, but I would say by sophomore year, maybe junior year, I had kind of come to this realization that, being in school is like a question of diminishing returns when it comes to how much time you apply to your theoretical schoolwork, right? So you can spend 40 hours studying for a test and get a B+, or you can spend 80 hours studying for a test and you get an A-, right? And so then the question is like, okay, that additional 40 hours, is it better spent getting the A minus in that class, or you find the B plus and instead use those 40 hours to do something practical with that knowledge? And I opted for the latter, and it's definitely something I encourage whenever I'm talking to anyone who's going into university to think about what that right balance is for them. It's different for different people. But for me, certainly, being able to do practical projects just reinforced the learning, and it helped me understand why I was learning the things I was learning in my classes. And in the time since I've done that, certainly Cornell and a lot of other universities have kind of held on to this concept of the maker movement and have done a much better job, actually, of providing outlets and resources for students to do things that are hands-on and practical and apply the things they're learning in their classes. And so Cornell's done a much really good job of that over the last couple of years from what I've seen looking in from the outside.
Yeah.
But it was an important part of my time there. Yeah.
Yeah. That's real cool. So speaking of the practical piece, I see you were also working for MakerBot. Is that while you were in college? Is that right?
Yeah. So initially, going into my junior year, I was in this program at Cornell called the Kessler Fellowship, where basically you apply, you give some indication of why you're entrepreneurial and why you want to work at a startup, and the school gives you a stipend to basically pay you to work at a startup or in some kind of startup environment where the startup might not otherwise be able to pay an intern. So you do this fellowship with the intention that you're in a startup environment, you're learning about the business side of it, but also contributing technical knowledge with your engineering degree that you're working on. So that was how I started it at MakerBot. That first summer, I was working on electronics there and the business side of things as well, trying to understand what it takes to make a young company like that. At that time, MakerBot was, I think, 20 people. And this was before they went through all these things with open source, and we don't have to get into that right now.
Yeah.
After that, I continued to consult for them remotely from school, and I went back and worked there the following summer part-time and worked over the winter and continued to do some remote consulting work for them, basically doing electrical design for the Replicator 3D printer and the Digitizer 3D scanner. It was a really fun learning experience for me. It was a really great time.
Yeah, that's cool. I think the Replicator... Or I guess the 3D printer for MakerBot, that might have been one of the first ones like I actually used. And so when I saw that, I was like, oh man, he actually helped make that. That's cool. Well, sweet. So you're in college and you get your master's and you graduate, and it feels like you kind of go to the mecca of especially engineering nowadays at Google. What was that like? Was that kind of your end goal all along?
No, you know, I didn't know what my end goal was. I mean, I still don't know what my end goal is, right?
Yeah.
I think a lot of people don't, and that's okay. So after I finished my undergrad, I considered going out into the world of work and potentially doing my own startup. I was like, I still feel like I have unfinished business at Cornell, so I did the master's. And through a series of interesting events, I got connected to the right folks at Google. And it just kind of seemed like a perfect fit for what I wanted to do next. I never had previously seen myself working at really kind of any large company, but I had the small company experience. I had also had a medium company experience. I wanted to see what it was like to work for a big juggernaut that has a ton of money to throw at problems. And see what that's like. And it was awesome. I mean, being at Google was a great time. And I loved my time there. It's an amazing company. And I worked at Google X, which has now since been spun out as a separate company under Alphabet, which is the new umbrella.
Yeah.
But at the time, it was kind of their crazy research division where they did crazy stuff. And I got the opportunity to basically work at a company that has, gives you a blank check to do crazy things and to solve difficult problems. And it was some of the most amazing learning experiences that I have had for sure. And I got to contribute to building awesome things.
Yeah. And you were working on Google Glass. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, the majority of my time there was spent working on Google Glass. The thing that attracted me to it initially, and this is the thing that attracts me to any of the stuff I've worked on, is kind of opening up capabilities for people. I'm not a huge fan of the way Glass ended up being marketed, and I think it had some of the things to do with why it ended up not really becoming a true commercial success, although it did have enterprise success later, which is something that I worked on. One of the initial things that attracted me to it was they would show these videos of, you know, someone who was quadriplegic, who wanted to be able to explore on her own and had trouble doing it because it was really difficult for her to communicate with people remotely. And then there was someone who was a photographer who, I don't remember if they had developed Parkinson's or something along those lines, they couldn't photograph anymore. And this was giving them the ability to do that. Or there was a firefighter who was using it, who had written his own software for it to help aid him in navigating buildings when doing fire rescues. And stuff like that, basically building hardware that extends the capabilities of what we think humans are capable of, either because they've had capabilities taken away for some reason, or just because they want to be able to do even more and kind of have superpowers. That really excited me. And it was the combination of that and just the intense technical challenges in making that product. It was a very complicated product to make. It was also one of Google's first true internally built hardware products. Mm-hmm. Google had a lot of money to throw at this problem, but they were still, you know, relatively novice to building hardware and what's involved in that. And building hardware is hard. It's called that for a reason, especially at scale. And there were a lot of learning experiences there. And I wanted to kind of be able to experience that from a company that was new to that process, but would also have all the resources necessary to try to overcome the issues that you generally face when building a hardware product.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so cool. You know, I was watching the YouTube video of your Jarvis home automation, and I was like, oh, cool. He's recording it with Google Glass. He must have been one of those lucky guys that like got to get like a free pair or got to buy a pair. And then I was like going back, like, nope, pretty sure he helped make it. So that's why he got one. But the Jarvis piece, full out Tony Stark mode, and the home automation stuff. Is that still a project? Is that ongoing?
Yeah, it's been ongoing for like the last several years now, and I've kind of torn the whole thing apart and restarted it from scratch like 4 times. People have asked me a couple times, like, oh, you know, why don't you make a company around this? And this was 4 or 5 years ago, before Google or Apple or Amazon had gotten into this space.
Yeah,
and I was doing, I had been learning a lot about voice-based control in my time at Google, because Google was building a lot of those systems initially for your phone, and also we were building them for Glass, and it was an interesting set of problems there in terms of power consumption and all these things. But I was learning more about voice activation and natural language processing and all these things, and it was a fascinating topic to me, but slightly out of my wheelhouse as an electrical engineer. And I had always tinkered with this kinds of home automation things. And I was like, oh, I'm just going to, you know, build a voice controlled home assistant thing. This was a few years before like Alexa had come out and stuff like that. And those systems now blow anything that I've done out of the water. But at the time it was pretty cool and I still use it. It was a way for me to learn about natural language processing, a way for me to kind of work on my software chops. I'm not a software engineer, nor do I want to be a full-time software engineer, but it is nonetheless an important part of my job day to day. You know, I design electronics, but I also got to write software for testing and all kinds of stuff. And so better understanding those principles is useful. And home automation was a great route to explore those techniques. And it kind of gave me an opportunity to meld some hardware design stuff and something practical that I actually wanted for my home, with learning new software techniques. And so as I've gotten better at the right way to write those types of software and interface with online APIs and do all types of things, I've kind of torn it apart and restarted the whole infrastructure from scratch again. So it's gotten more and more sophisticated as time has gone on, but it's also like you know, taking a nosedive for a couple months, not work at all on like ripping out all the pieces and figuring out how to redo it. But it's a fun experience, and it's a cool way to teach yourself about a wide range of software and hardware topics because it covers so many things.
Yeah, that's cool. Even the just how you're, I guess, shaking the phone just to turn on the lights. I was like, man, I would totally do that and just mess with my wife all the time.
It is by far the most used. I mean, I have all this voice automation stuff, but just the in bed at night, shake the phone to turn the lights off is by far my most used feature.
Yeah, it's like the 21st century, like clap on or something. That's sweet. So. All right, so you're working at Google, you're working at like Google X, and I love the title they give you guys are the hardware astronauts. And I always hear people talk about kind of Google X in hallowed grounds. But then you made the shift, like you mentioned, a little bit back towards the making side of things and even the woodworking from when you were a kid with Shaper. What drew you to Shaper? And you're the head of electrical engineering, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, so what... Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just say kind of how did you get interested in them and see what they were working on?
Yeah, so my first introduction to Shaper. So at Google, I worked on the electrical design for glass, mostly working on the electrical design for what became the Enterprise Edition of Glass, which is it's what's now used by enterprises and medical professionals and stuff. While I was there, I was also kind of always on the lookout for interesting new technology. So me and this guy Joe, who's now the CEO of Shaper. So Joe was in charge of the product design team on Google Glass, so I worked with him a lot there. And so Joe and I were two of these people who would go out and scout and kind of look at interesting new technology that we thought might be related to some of the things that we were doing at Google. And working on glass. And so we would go to different trade shows and stuff. And so one of the first introduction that I had to Shaper, actually both Joe and I, was at SolidCon, which was this hardware conference in San Francisco in, I don't remember what year it was, 2014, I guess.
Okay.
So we met Alec. Alec is one of the co-founders of Shaper, and he was there at the show demoing a very early prototype of the tool. And I remember Joe and I walked out of that show and we're like, okay, everything there was like fine. But oh man, did you see the Shaper booth? That thing was so freaking cool.
Yeah.
And so Joe ended up going on to get more involved in advising Shaper while he was at Google. Just, you know, general advising. And eventually left Google to go join Alec and Alon, who's the other co-founder of Shaper, to become the CEO. So Alec and Alon both have technical backgrounds. They're from MIT. Alon more on the mechanical side and Alec on the computer vision side. And so they brought Joe on as CEO. And around that time, I was starting to get a little restless at Google, was kind of ready for the next challenge. And, you know, I admired Joe a lot and I admired what Shaper was doing. And I have always had this thread of being involved in wanting to make stuff. And like I said earlier, my personal focus and like my personal mantra in terms of things I want to work on is like, I want to work on things that help people in some way. It doesn't always have to mean like I'm finding the cure for cancer. But I want to give people tools that they can use to be creative in their own way or to extend their own capabilities. And so Shaper fit that perfectly. You know, it would give me the opportunity to get back to kind of building things, both the tool itself and building things with it. And so that was kind of a no-brainer for me. And I left Google to join Shaper. I guess it was almost a year after Joe. I don't remember exactly. But I've been at Shaper now for a little over 2 years. I mean, it was awesome. It was the perfect blend of being able to get back into things that people used to make stuff. And I had previously done that kind of thing at MakerBot.
Yeah.
And even before that. And it was, you know, just like the perfect mix of things. And I got to get back into the startup environment, which I'm personally really fond of and had had plenty of experience with before. And the Google experience was great, and I loved it there. And I can't speak highly enough of the people I worked with at Google, especially because a lot of the people I worked with at Google now work with me at Shaper.
Yeah.
But going back to the startup scene was a lot of fun, and I don't think I'd trade it for anything.
Yeah. What's it been like? It sounds like you've always been a part of the maker community, especially post-college or even while you're in college. Is it weird? It's almost like you've flipped roles and now you're on the side where you're like producing the tools that like the makers are getting at these shows and stuff like that.
I mean, in a sense, I've always kind of been on that side. I got a little bored early on of just making stuff, and I wanted to teach other people how to make stuff. And that was, I had a series of YouTube videos, and then I wrote a book about it. And I was building resources for people to learn how to do stuff. And so that's always been a huge area of fascination for me. I consider myself to be relatively creative, but I also feel that there's a lot of people out there who are a lot more creative than I am. And I love to see the things that they make. And if I can give them a tool that unleashes their creativity and allows them to do things that they otherwise couldn't, I mean, that is what makes me happiest at the end of the day. Now that we've started shipping out Shaper Origin to customers and people are starting to get them in their hands, my favorite thing when I wake up in the morning is I bring out the website and I'm looking at the forum where all of our customers are sharing things that they're starting to build and produce. And I can see people making stuff and like, wow, I made this thing and I had no way to do this previously. Or, this thing would have taken me like 3 hours before and now I did it in 5 minutes. And seeing the things that people are making with a tool that I helped create is a very rewarding experience for me.
Yeah. Has there been like a use case or a type of project that folks are using that you guys never would have expected now that it's out in the wild?
So we started beta testing early prototypes of this tool about 2 years before it even ended up in like actual paying consumers' hands. So we had a lot of data going in. And I actually think that's something great that Shaper did that a lot of companies could learn from. And it influenced our design decisions a lot and made sure that we tried to cover our bases for what crazy things people might do. That being said, we always knew that, once there were a few hundred or a few thousand out in the world, as opposed to the few dozen that we've been beta testing with, that we would see new use cases. And sure enough, that's the case. One of the very first people to get it dove right into like milling a big aluminum sign with cutting fluid, which is not something that we had tested before. Doing wet cutting.
Oh, cool.
It wasn't really designed for it, but it worked. The tool is designed to work on hardwood, softwood, soft metals. So it'll cut aluminum and plastics and composites and things like that. But we knew our biggest audience was going to be woodworking. So it was surprising to see the very first thing pop up be someone wet cutting metal. But it was awesome. And we've seen people do a huge range of stuff with it. I would say it's a big range of people, but there's two key markets that I see in terms of the biggest users right now. One is people who are kind of like prosumer sort of woodworkers, maybe not people who do it professionally, but like have a workshop in their garage, like making cool stuff, want to make stuff with their kids, maybe don't have a ton of space or a ton of tools. And for the listeners who aren't familiar with Shaper Origin, I should probably explain what it is. It's basically a handheld CNC machine, and you can go look up videos of it online, but it's a small, portable, compact tool you can put away at the end of the day when you're done using it, and it gives you a lot of the capabilities that you would have with a traditional, very large, very expensive CNC machine that might, take up your entire garage, but it takes up basically no space, and the cutting area that the tool can handle, it goes from very tiny, intricate work. We've had people making like brass jewelry with it, all the way up to cutting full size, like 4x8 sheets of plywood and larger. So it has kind of an unlimited build area, and the tool compensates for your movement as you use it. So you move Origin around your workpiece, you do the rough cutting motions, and Origin compensates for you in real time, so you get like a machine quality cut with a ham tool. You load designs on via USB or via the web, and we're building out an inventory of designs that you can download and use and put on the tool, so you can say, oh, this weekend I want to make a new chair with my kids. And you can just download that design. It pops up on the tool. You follow the directions. You do the rough cuts, and you get a high-quality product, even if you're not an experienced woodworker. So back to what I was saying about the types of people. So that's kind of one group of people is more hobbyist type. And then the other group is people who do this for a living. And they're either like cabinet makers or kitchen outfitters or contractors or people who do commissioned work out of metal and wood and things like that, sign makers. And for them, it's giving them workflows that they didn't have before. And I mentioned before about, you know, really giving people superpowers. It gives them construction superpowers, something that would require a ton of jigs or hours of work or tons of planning can now be done like very simply, reproducibly, without external jigs, without all these other things that you would have needed previously. And so it's letting people do things they couldn't otherwise do. And it's super exciting to see that.
Yeah, that's so cool. Yeah, I'm definitely in that first camp of tinkering. I've got like a little inventable CNC. But when I first started seeing the videos, I was like, wait, what does this do again? And then I saw the text like autocorrect for your hands. And then I started getting into like how it actually worked. I was like, oh man, this is really, really cool. It's like, it's a different type category that you guys are building. And then especially I started seeing videos and pictures of like joints, especially like mortise and tenons. I'm like, man, those take hours to make by hand, and this thing is just knocking out. It's so cool. But I guess what I wanted to ask, so with the name Origin, do you guys see like the future of more tools like this where you're combining computers to help correct for the human side of things, but it's still like a hands-on approach to making?
Yeah, so we like to call ourselves a human-involved robotics company. Okay. And so we're kind of, to your point about sort of creating this new category, we kind of sit in this interesting place between people who are doing straight-up hand construction, either using like old Japanese techniques, things like that. Yeah. And then all the way on the other end of the spectrum is like fully automated $100,000 gantry CNC that's churning out tables for IKEA. Yeah. Right. So we're at this interesting place in the middle, which is a lot of what really excites me about Shaper, where we're really just giving people superpowers. We're augmenting your existing capabilities. So we think that there's something to be said and people really like being in the loop when it comes to making stuff. You get a much different feeling when you say, okay, I want to make this chair. It's one thing if you, okay, like great, the chair can be made out of flat plywood construction and put together with no joints, and you put it on a CNC machine, it cuts all the things out for you, and it's like, okay, you have a chair. That's a very different feeling from, okay, I want to make this chair. I'm going to get this tool out, and I'm going to physically be making this myself. And at the end of the day, when you look at that chair, you emotionally, you feel a lot different about a chair that you made with Shaper Origin versus one that came out of a CNC. No. That being said, you know, I'm not advocating Shaper Origin for IKEA to start mass producing cabinets, right? There's a time and a place for all kinds of tools. We kind of give people the ability to make handcrafted things, but basically guarantee that those handcrafted things are going to come out looking really great and be something that you're really proud of, even if you don't have a ton of experience making stuff. And that's a really empowering feeling for people. And I can, you know, speak for personal experience there. My girlfriend and I have built a lot of the stuff in our apartment with Origin.
That's cool.
It's really rewarding to be able to use stuff that you really had a hand in designing and making. And then the other big part of the equation with Origin is you can trial and error, and you can fiddle with things as you go. And the way the tool works, since you're in control of kind of the CAM operations, there's no CAM in a traditional sense with Shaper Origin. So like with traditional CNC machining, you make a design on a computer, you set up the CAM operations, which tells the robotic CNC system where it needs to move the cutting bit when to do certain things. we don't have a sense of that. It's totally up to you what order you want to do things in, how you want to do them, how many passes you want to do. That's all up to you. And you can make changes on the fly. So like one of the super powerful things that we can do that just totally changes your workflow entirely is you mentioned mortise and tenon joints before. So you want to make a mortise and tenon joint that fits together perfectly. You can cut one side of that and then cut the other side. And first off, you know, you can do all that design on the tool. And then, okay, so you do a test fit and you're like, I think I want this to just be like a little looser. So you can go back and you can shave off like 1/1000th of an inch at a time from your mortise or tenon and until you get that fit perfect. And you can do this trial and error and figure it out as you go. And that's just not something you can do with like a fully robotic system. And so human in the loop lets you do totally crazy things and experiment on the fly and adjust your measurements as you go. And it kind of brings the capabilities of a fully manual hand tool woodworking process into the 21st century.
Yeah, it's so cool. It's almost like, at least it feels to me like the Blue Apron HelloFresh for cooking, like for those that still like want to like create something with their hands, but like it's a little bit easier because you're getting a lot of the stuff sent to you already. So it almost feels to that to me. It's so neat. I just saw, I think it was this morning at the time of this recording, this early January, the test had put out a video of like a full out walkthrough, especially if guys are interested in checking it out. It's really neat. But cool. So with tested, so, or not with tested, with the Origin, you guys have your pre-orders going out and you guys are taking orders right now. For 2018, kind of, are you guys moving into full like production manufacturing mode, or kind of what's the big thing on the horizon for you guys?
Yeah, I mean, so we're in full scale manufacturing right now. I would say we're still ramping up to full speed production. But we started taking pre-orders, what was it, like September of 2016 or so. And so we have lots of pre-orders to get through. And so we're still in the process of catching up to those right now. So you can still order now, and you kind of get put on the queue to get the, you know, Shape Origin when we catch up to your pre-order number. So we're fulfilling pre-orders at an ever-increasing rate as we get the manufacturing ramped up to the full speed of the max number of units that we want to be making per day, basically. And yeah, we're shipping them out as fast as we can. I think if you were like order today being like middle of January, you would expect to see it priced like sometime this summer, like early this summer, depending on how fast we get through pre-orders, something like that. I don't have an exact date, but yeah, we're catching up.
That's cool. Well, man, I appreciate you taking the time and chatting with me. You guys are making some pretty incredible stuff. Are you still keep a time for your own tinkering too outside of all this?
When I can. I would say, so definitely Shaper more than any other job I've previously had, even Google. And, you know, I would say I arguably worked more hours at Google, but I had a huge commute getting there.
Yeah.
Shaper more than any job I've had is just, it's so fulfilling to me from both a work perspective and the fact that I work on side projects at Shaper, like building things with the tools.
Cool.
And so, you know, that keeps me pretty occupied. But, you know, I always have time for my little side projects. I'm still tinkering on Jarvis here and there. And I'm working on some more like video type stuff. And I have this book that I wrote that I still maintain the website for and update tutorials and things along those lines. So I'm still busy with lots of other stuff.
Yeah. And I forgot to mention the book. So Exploring Arduino, that came out in 2014. Is that right?
Yeah. 2013.
Oh, 2013. Okay. I'm looking forward to dive in actually into that. Electronics this year for me is one of the big things I want to add to what I do. And I was like, I need someone just to give me like a really good overview of Arduino and all the stuff I can do. And I was like, oh, this is what I need to do. So
yeah, I was very pleasantly surprised by the reception of the book. And actually the the class that I took at Cornell during my undergrad, which is the first time I was introduced to Arduino, now uses the book as a textbook.
Oh, really? That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's cool. That's really cool. Well, sweet. So I guess for your personal projects and everything, just jeremybloom.com, is that the best place to send people?
Yeah, that's the best place to find any stuff that I'm working on personally. And if you're interested in Shaper, that's shapertools.com. Or, you know, at this point, you can probably just Google badass handheld CNC machine pop up.
That needs to be at the top of your guys' website. That's the one thing you're missing. So that's awesome. Well, man, I appreciate your time and chat with me. It was a blast.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's good talking to you.
All right, thanks for sticking around to the very end. This is the portion where I give you a quick update about the things that I am working on inside of my shop. So if you guys did not know, I actually have a entirely separate YouTube channel that's the Make or Break Shop that is kind of along with the show, but it's my own builds. And so these are my best attempts at doing things that I think are pretty cool. So I actually just put out a crib build video because we have a baby coming literally any day now. So that might affect even the schedule of this podcast a little bit in addition to the schedule of the videos. But we got a couple other ones coming out that include making one of those like pegboard walls that you would put in a nursery, in addition to having some shelving that you can put some really cool kids' books on. So I encourage you guys to check those videos out and let me know what you think of the format and the pacing. I really want to dial that in to keep it interesting for you guys. So I hope you are having a great week and you guys are building something really cool. And as always, go have fun and make or break something in your shop. Till next time, see you guys.